Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from Costco Business Center, offering delivery to Anchorage Air Cargo companies for shipments to rural Alaska for business and home. More at CostcoBusinessDelivery.com.
Changes are coming to Alaska's foster care system. New legislation aims to help foster kids find safe, permanent homes more quickly, but doing that requires a lot of changes, from reducing caseloads to requiring workers to seek out family members. Today on Talk of Alaska, we'll discuss what's in the works and why it matters.
Talk of Alaska is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters.
This is Talk of Alaska. I'm Ann Hillman. Nearly 3,000 children and young adults are in Alaska's foster care system. Changes are in their works to reduce that number and place kids in safe, loving, long-term homes. Today, we'll discuss what those changes are and how they affect children and families. My guests today are Sarah Redman, a former foster youth and an advocate, Amanda Mativier, the director of Facing Foster Care in Alaska, Christy Lawton, director of the Office of Children's Services, and Representative Les Guerra. Thank you all very much for being here. Listeners, do you have experiences with the foster care system? Were you a foster kid yourself? Do you have questions about how it works? Let us know by calling 1-800-478-8255 or here in Anchorage, 550-8422. You can also email talk@alaskapublic.org. So today we're talking about changes to the system, but before we really get into all the nuts and bolts and things that are happening on the ground, I want to talk about why we should care about this and why this is significant. So, Sarah, I'd like to turn to you. Many of the changes that are happening now aim to get kids and young people into permanent homes faster. So I was wondering if you could share a bit of your story about entering foster care and trying to find a forever home.
So I entered foster care three different times in my life. First started when I was 11. Was in care for about a year, and then my goal was reunification with my biological parents. So I reunified after a year. A couple of years later, I went back in when I was 14. Moved around a few times from home to home. Became homeless actually after that due to the system. They weren't listening to what I wanted, kind of.
So what do you mean you became homeless? Like you were living at Covenant House?
I was couch surfing from home to home, looking for places to sleep, staying at friends' houses, staying at former foster parents' houses, someplace where I could not be out in the cold. After that, during my time, about 16, I joined Facing Foster Care in Alaska, and I met Amanda, and during the time from when I entered the system to 14 to exiting, not really exiting the system. We had did the works in trying to extend foster care until you're 21. And then we also amended that bill so that we could re-enter the foster care system once after your 18th birthday. So I actually took the opportunity to re-enter the system. Okay. So that was actually going to be my third time back in the system when I was 18 years old. So I stayed from 18 to 21 looking for a permanent placement, just trying to find a family that would just be there to support me in anything I needed. Somebody that would, call me for family dinners, where I can go for Christmas, or, just somebody to call me every day. Not even just call me and just to see how I'm doing, like, oh, hey, Sarah, how are you doing today? Or, oh, what's your plans this weekend? Just something like that. I mean, that's permanency to me. Someone that's actually going to be there even when you fall back on your feet, when they don't like something that you do, but they're still there to try to support you in your decisions you make. I think that's what permanency is. And that's, what youth look for.
And did you, could you ever find permanency?
I did not find permanency while in the foster care system. I did try to find permanency. It just weren't the best fits, I would say. So I'm still looking now. It's just, you know, just somebody that's going to be there to support me every day.
And, I mean, you're 24 now?
Yes.
And how does it still affect you that you've never found that? You've never had that long-term support system that you know will be there?
I mean, it affects me, I think, on a daily basis. You know, just going, you know, home to my own place, you know, by myself. I mean, not having somebody just check in on me. I mean, I was in a car accident in October. It took me 30 minutes to find somebody just to come and actually come get me before, you know, I actually got in it. So, I mean, if I was to have that permanent connection, I think I would have been able to, you know, have that support immediately when I need it. Like, I can just pick up the phone and they're going to be there for me when I, at any situation. I mean, a flat tire in the middle of the night, who's going to be there for me?
Mm-hmm.
I don't have anybody to call.
Amanda, you work with kids across the state. How common is Sarah's story?
A lot of our youth who age out of the system, so who don't find permanent connections through adoption or guardianships, they exit care without that forever family, or face a lot of challenges. And we see high rates of incarceration and homelessness and early pregnancy. And so I think the ultimate goal is to make sure that youth are connected to at least one caring adult before they leave care, because it is those things, someone to call in time of crisis, but also someone to celebrate successes with. We have a lot of our youth who are now out on their own and they're having children and they need grandparents for their children and, you know, someone to spend the holidays with. We have youth that go off to college and are really successful, but then are in the dorms during winter break without, you know, a connection to somebody, anyone checking on them to say, happy holidays, Merry Christmas. We do gift drives and try to find ways to support young people. But I think it makes all the difference in the world when you have an adult, someone in your life that cares about you to help you with things. Like, the state can help pay for driver's education for a 16-year-old, but it makes all the difference in the world when you have an adult that can teach you how to drive.
Christy, is statistically speaking, do a lot of kids end up aging out versus finding permanent homes, or going from home to home, as Sarah has and other stories I've heard have?
Well, typically about 50% of our children actually end up reunifying with their parents, which is great. We'd like that number to be higher. The other 50% often end up getting permanency through adoption or guardianship. We have in the last 5 years made significant improvements. We did previously have a lot of youth that had a goal of what's called APLA, another planned permanent living arrangement. It's a federal terminology and really just means that kids were exiting without having really the kinds of connections that we really wanted them to have. So working with Facing Foster Care in Alaska, we really revisited our policies and our practices and have really narrowed that number, because our goal is that there's not a single youth that leaves that doesn't have that permanent connection for somebody that's going to be there for them long term.
Mm-hmm. So with adoption, with 50%, what is that process like, adopting a child out of the foster care system?
Well, it really depends on how they sort of came to it. Sometimes these are relatives, so they've had a relationship with the child, or maybe they're relatives that were only, you know, met the youth when they came into foster care. We do have people that come to foster care specifically looking to adopt, although that's not something we typically encourage, because, you know, foster care is supposed to be temporary. We're not an adoption agency per se. But that, all that being said, is a lot of times when children have been with foster parents for a long time and no other relatives have been identified, often they grow to love, and of course they want then that child to be a part of their forever family. So a lot of times that's how adoption occurs, is through those long-term connections they make with the child's in care.
And if you end up adopting from the system, are there provisions put in place to provide supports if you end up adopting a former foster youth, or things to help provide health care?
Yes, so children that are adopted are eligible for Medicaid, so to get continued health benefits. And then we do negotiate what's called a subsidy, which is based on the child's special needs. So it really sort of depends on what are the challenges, the issues. There's some identified sort of high-risk categories that help with subsidies. For example, if it's a large sibling group, you know, the federal government and the state recognizes that's a harder group to adopt if you want them to be together. And so subsidies are put in place to really get children to permanency that might otherwise not be able to.
All right. And I'd like to go straight to the calls, phones right now, actually. We have Susan in Juneau. Susan, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Hi. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, I'm excited that you're having this because I think there's a lot of kids out there that need to be adopted. And my husband and I have adopted, and we're very excited. We love our child. We were fortunate enough to get her when she was young. And she is currently in high school. Mm-hmm. I think there's some concerns that the state needs to address, though, and that's the expense of adoption.
The expense of adoption from the foster care system or in general?
Well, just to adopt a child is expensive, and I don't think it should be expensive. I mean, the legal fees and stuff are expensive, and I think that, you know, it should be, if you have a loving heart and you're out there and you'd love to care for a child or can take a child into your family, we need to make that happen so that these kids aren't sitting in the system. There's no reason for that.
Christy, would you like to respond?
Sure. So the state does offer a legal stipend, if you will. I'm not sure that's the exact term we use, but we do offer financial support for those looking to adopt. Last time I checked, it was around $2,000. And so depending, of course, on your location and the availability of attorneys, that may cover all of it, or there may be additional. And that's certainly sometimes there are contested matters that happen in adoption, and I know those can become quite costly. But typically, the $2,000 covers the bulk of the expenses. But if that's not been Susan's experience, I'd certainly love to talk with her further about that.
All right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, ours was a little more difficult, and part of it was the, you know, how you have to terminate the privileges of parents and such. It gets to be costly, and I think that if we could make it somehow where there was no real expense to it and really just show our Alaskan people, you know, adoption is a wonderful way to go. We were fortunate enough for our child to bring another lesson into our family. We have four children now, and we don't refer to children as biological or non-biological. They're ours. There's not this mix anymore. Mm-hmm. And it's just, it's a blessing for us. And those people out there that are thinking of it, I really encourage you to explore it because you're going to get a whole lot of love and happiness out of it.
All right. Well, thanks very much for calling, Susan.
Thank you. Have a good week.
You too. Les, some of the changes that are happening in the system now to achieve permanency, like Sarah was talking about, you've attempted to achieve through this House Bill 151. Tell us a little bit about what that bill does and how it helps kids find a permanent home.
Sure. At the outset, you know, Alaska faces a unique circumstance. We have a child abuse rate that's roughly five times, or that's roughly in the top five of the nation. Child abuse and neglect 70% higher than the national average. So we have a larger number of youth proportionally coming into the system. The question is how to get them out. Like foster care, when I was a kid, was viewed as a permanent thing. Today, we're supposed to try and put the foster care system out of business. And so there are good statistics nationally on how you do that. Number one, it's not going to work if you have an overwhelmed system, a new worker comes in and then leaves within the first year, doesn't get to know the child, doesn't get to know the family. And that is linked to longer stays in foster care, less chance of a child being reunified with a parent. Every single bad statistic that you have in your system is created when you have an overwhelmed system with lots of turnover. So the bill establishes caseload averages. And we're going to get, you're supposed to have about 12 or 15 cases on a caseworker's docket so they can work a case and get a kid out of the system, back to their natural family, into an adoptive home. In Wasilla last year, we had caseloads not of 12 or 15, but 43 to 45 to 50. We're changing that. And as you do that, you're going to have time to work with children, to work with families, to get them reunified faster, out of the system faster, or adopted faster. And
why would a child be reunified faster if there's more caseworkers?
It's all evidence-based. So the evidence is the more time a caseworker has to arrange visits with a natural family, the more incentive the family that's lost the child has to sort of work on the problems that they're facing, their demons, whether it's substance abuse or some other issue, because they see the child on a regular basis and they want that child back more and more and more every time they see them. So the statistics are the more visitation there is early on, the more likely there is going to be reunification. The less visitation, because you've got a foster care caseworker in crisis and they do one round of visitation instead of 10, the less likely there's going to be reunification.
And I think just to add to that, Anne, I would just say that a lot of what we do comes down to relationships. And relationships are everything, particularly in child welfare, when you're dealing with people that are in crisis and dealing with the kinds of complex social and emotional challenges that our families face. And so every time a worker changes over, to be able to reestablish a relationship and to really get to know that child and family so you can try to meet their needs, it becomes increasingly difficult. Mm-hmm. And we know, based on research again, that every time a caseworker turns over, the likelihood a child's going to stay in care grows by 6 to 8 months. And so when you have the kind of turnover we've experienced in recent years, it really, really minimizes and decreases the good outcomes that we can have with children at all aspects of the case.
And Sarah, did you have a relationship with your caseworker when you were in foster care?
No, not really. I had quite a bit. I had about 5 caseworkers in my 7 years of care.
Wow.
Yeah.
And Amanda, you've been in foster care, you've been a foster parent, you've been involved in a lot of levels of the system. Have you had much experience with consistency with caseworkers? Or
I actually, so I was fortunate enough to have one placement and to remain with my sibling and to have a really good experience in the system. I think it worked for me, but I think that's because I had consistency in my worker. I had a really good relationship with my caseworker. I did have 3 over the course of 3 years, but I had, I don't know, meaningful relationships and got to know them. They understood my situation, worked well with my family. And so I think that that really made all the difference. When you look forward to that visit, somebody coming to see you, somebody coming to ask questions about your life, I think it makes a big difference.
And that's actually a great segue into an audio clip from Isaiah King. And he talks about he entered foster care as a young kid and he bounced around a lot between homes and between treatment centers. But in this quick story, he talks about what it was like to find that permanent home.
I was parked in the street because there was no parking spots in my parking lot, and my GL pulls up and says, "Oh hey," I was like, "Oh hey," and walk into my house, and this older lady slightly almost backs up into my car, and like, I'm like, "Oh, whoa, what are you doing?" And she's like, "Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't see it there." My GL, he's like, "This is your CASA worker." I was like, "Oh, wait, what? What is that?" "Oh, she's gonna be there when I'm not there." And she was literally there when he was not there. Like, she would text me every day, and it was just overwhelming. She would do the most, like, I felt like she really, like, got to know me. Every time we met, like, we would really just, you know, talk about me and stuff, and it really helped the bond. Eventually, when my foster mom moved out of state, I asked her to be my mom because I feel like she really earned that, you know. And I've always wanted a forever home, and I just got adopted, and I'm so lucky to have her as my mom.
So that was Isaiah King, who was recently adopted out of the foster care system. Amanda, you are sitting over there smiling and grinning.
I just think it's a sweet story. I mean, Isaiah, I know really well, and he was adopted at 19. And I think it's never too late. Our young people always want a family. And he talks over and over about just really wanting a mom and dad. That's incredibly important at any age, even at 30.
And for those who are just tuning in, this is Talk of Alaska, and today we're talking about changes to the foster care system. Do you have questions about how it works, things that you would like to see have happen? Give us a call statewide at 1-800-478-8255. 8255 or here in Anchorage at 550-8422. You can also email talk@alaskapublic.org. So it seems like the major changes that are happening are fewer cases for each caseworker. And this has already happened in Wasilla starting last year. Is that true, Christy?
Yeah, so last year, the legislature, we had an appropriation that enabled us to add 31 new positions statewide, and the bulk of those positions did go to our Mat-Su field office because they were the ones that had really experienced the most growth and were struggling. Those positions have all been hired, and we're seeing significant improvements out there. The morale alone is huge, but the cases are moving. The numbers of adoptions, the number of reunifications are increasing every month, and so that sort of workforce infusion that we're able to give them is paying off.
And so what's the plan from here on out?
So from here on out, HB 151 gave us an additional 21 positions. They're not all caseworkers. There are some supervisors, some support staff. We'll be looking at placing those around statewide based on the need and, of course, hiring. And really, what we talked with the legislature, what we worked with Representative Garrett on is that in order to get some stabilization, we really needed an infusion of caseworkers so that while we're getting those people trained and hired, which takes, weeks and months to do, we'll have enough support for the people that are staying. So really sort of bringing in a good surge, if you will, of staffing so that we can protect people that are staying. And I think over the course of the next year to 2 years, we'll see that reduction of cases statewide and hopefully get it at a level that's manageable depending on where they are. And that number might vary slightly.
Mm-hmm. And then hopefully reduce the turnover.
Absolutely. That's one of the major factors we know when we survey our staff about if they're thinking about leaving. And of course, some of the exit surveys also tell us that is workload and doing a job that they feel like was not what they came to do because they came to work and help kids and families and reunify kids and families. And when you have a caseload of 40 or 45, it's impossible to do the kind of work that the people that come to child welfare that are called to do this really special work, they just really can't face themselves every day when they can't do it. And so it really does drive people out the doors when they can't accomplish it. And of course, that's what we want for all kids and families is good outcomes.
And you mentioned a moment ago training. A big part of this bill is also increasing the amount of training. Les, I was hoping you could kind of talk about that element of it.
Sure. We borrowed the best provisions we could find from around the country. And as of 2 years ago, the amount of training was about all the legislature provided enough money for was about 3 weeks of training. And so 3 weeks of training, caseworker came in, had an overwhelming caseload left. And what we're going to do is 6 weeks of training, not an overwhelming caseload. And we're going to hopefully replicate what happened in New Jersey, which is their turnover rate went down by 75%. And but the goal is really, as much as we want to make lives for caseworkers better, the goal is to make lives for kids and families better. And so the ultimate result of all of the complex stuff in this bill is kids are going to get out of foster care faster, into a loving home faster. The longer you're in foster care, the more you bounce from one family to another family. You're suffering trauma just in the foster care system. For folks who know about ACEs scores, your ACEs scores, your bad mental health scores go up the longer you're in the system. We want to get you out into a loving home, into what Amanda and Sarah call a forever home. Because if you're 21 years old and you haven't found that home yet, who do you call? Right? The average in many states of the age of a child who still lives at home with their natural parents is 25 years old. And we're tossing kids who are 21 years old out on the street if they haven't found a forever home. And what are they going to do? Who are they going to call? I mean, is it a surprise then that 29% of Alaska's foster youth end up in jail at some point or 50% end up homeless at some point? Those are the numbers we want to change. There are so many success stories out there, but we want everybody to be a success story, and that's what this bill's about.
All right. I'd like to jump back to the phones. We have Marcia in Skagway. Marcia, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Well, hello, and thank you for taking my call. I got in on the middle of the show, and I believe it was either Amanda or Sarah was speaking of the needs as a foster child turning to an adult and not having somebody there to call when they're at the hospital, when they need that flat tire changed or some assistance. And, you know, I myself, I've never thought of this side of the foster care system. I know that I'm not available to take younger children, but I'm certainly available and in the situation where I could be a foster parent or grandparent to these older foster children.
Is there a system set up to have, like, are you thinking more like a mentorship kind of support system or like having a child in your home?
A mentorship would be perfect.
Are there opportunities for that, Amanda?
There's a really great program that through Big Brothers Big Sisters, they actually partner with the Office of Children's Services to provide mentors to foster youth around the state ages 14 to 21. And a lot of those relationships I've seen once they've made the match go far beyond that. I've got young people now who aren't so young. They're 25, 26, and they still hang out with their big. So it's really cool to see those relationships and young people have connections to, you know, get jobs on the slope or just, you know, have support, a place to go on the holidays. And so that's a really great way to be able to connect with older youth. And then also signing up to be a CASA volunteer. So there's opportunities to volunteer.
What's a CASA volunteer?
It's a court-appointed special advocate. And so it's someone who basically volunteers to take on a case to represent children in court and make recommendations for their best interest, but they get assigned an OCS case and see it through from beginning to end. And a lot of times CASA volunteers, Isaiah has adopted him, but get a lot more time with a child. Usually they'll meet them weekly, get to know them on a personal basis, really get involved with their education, extracurricular activities, whatever they have going on. So that's a great way to also become a supportive adult.
Well, thanks very much. Mm-hmm. Marcia?
What was that name of the, what kind of volunteer?
CASA, C-A-S-A, Court-Appointed Special Advocate.
Okay, you know, that sounds absolutely perfect, and I really appreciate the show and letting people that want to help get introduced to these different programs and ways that we can help.
Well, thanks very much for calling.
Marcia, just this is Les Guerra. So a CASA would probably be the best fit for you if you don't want to be a foster or adoptive parent, because in communities with a court system, those exist everywhere. Amanda and I started the mentorship program, but with the limited funds we've been able to get so far, those are only in the larger communities right now through Big Brothers Big Sisters. And so, but a CASA, people love, when they become a CASA, they love being a CASA, and you get a lot of time with your youth.
Thank you again for calling. I want to turn to email now. Jim has written in and said he was in foster care in the 50s and 60s. He said, as a child of 13 welfare houses, not homes, in the 50s and 60s, I wanted to be with my siblings and what little family I had left, not in someone else's home and the abuse. I would have preferred to be in an orphanage or a group farm home. I did not want a loving mommy and daddy and the abuse, nor did I need it. He's talking about years and years and years ago, but I've heard different stories, similar, more contemporary. What sort of systems are in place to prevent what happened to Jim?
Well, I think we've come a long ways since the 50s and 60s. There used to be a lot of congregate care use, like orphanages. And really what, over time, what the research showed is that kids thrive and do better when they're in an environment that most resembles a home, with people that get to know them versus staff that might come in and out. Unlike many other states in the lower 48, we rely on congregate care or group care very little, and our goal is always to get children placed with relatives first and foremost, if we can.
I'd like you to go into that a little bit more. What do you do to try to make sure that kids are placed with relatives, and is that going to improve over time?
Sure. So really thinking about relatives and worst case scenario of a child coming into foster care is really what a caseworker starts from the very beginning, even sometimes at the point of intake. When the call first comes into our office with a worry about a child, we're often asking other information that has us documenting other people the child's connected to, like relatives, other people that know the child. If then we end up investigating a case, that is also something we're asking family, like who are other relatives, who do you have for supports? So that if 6 months, 6 years down the road, something happens that warrants that child coming into care, we hopefully, one, already have a startup or leg up on finding those relatives because there's been some prior conversations. But the law requires within the first 30 days that we do what's called an initial diligent relative search to find any and all possible relatives and reach out to them and let them know that they have the opportunity to ask for placement should they be suitable. After that 30 days, we also have a responsibility to do ongoing relative checking. So a part of what's in this bill really sort of strengthen that effort, take some additional steps whereby we're documenting, a supervisor's documenting and verifying that those searches happened as they should. Because the more we can get children placed with relatives first, we know that their outcomes are going to be better than if they're in stranger foster care.
And what about, he also mentions he really wanted to be with his siblings. Sarah, you have a lot of siblings. What was your, over your time in care and even now, what were your relationships with them like?
I have a lot. I am one of 12 siblings. I'm one of the older ones. When I was growing up, I had the responsibility of like being a mom in my house. Making sure they're up for school, making sure laundry's done, cooking dinner, all that good stuff. I kind of still play the mom role as I'm an adult. My relationship with them, it's rocky. It has its ups and downs. One of my siblings I actually really don't have a relationship with. She kind of just doesn't want to have a relationship with our family at this point in time, just due to everything that's happened in the past and, going through the foster care system. And now she's just ready to put that stuff, behind her and be an adult and just move on. Yeah.
When you were in the system, were you placed with any of your siblings? Did you have contact with them?
We did have contact. OCS actually did a really good job about trying to keep visitation. They actually had visitation set up weekly. So they would have transportation set up for us every week. On a Thursday, we would all go to the same location, have visitation for a couple hours. Being placed with the siblings, we were placed with siblings, but sometimes it was hard to be placed with siblings because there was no openings in the foster home. Some of the times I moved was due to wanting to be placed with my siblings, and a foster child would move out of a home and my sibling, there would be an empty bed, so I would want to move to be with that sibling. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, there was sometimes, yes, I was placed with siblings, sometimes no, because there was not availability.
Okay. We need to take a really quick break, and then we will be back with more of Talk of Alaska.
Today's program is underwritten in part by Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. Today we're talking about foster care in Alaska and things that are happening to try to improve the system, improve outcomes for kids and families. If you have experiences with the system, if you've been a caseworker, give us a call. Let us know what it's been like for you. Here in Anchorage, it's 550-8422. Statewide, 1-800-478-8255. And we're going to be taking a caller now from Anchorage. Welcome to Talk of Alaska. Hi, are you still on the line? All right, We will not be taking that call from Anchor. Mr. Patton, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Hey, how you doing this morning?
Good, and yourself?
Yeah, I wanted to call in. I heard you talking about social workers and turnover. Mm-hmm. We're dying, to say it the least. I know it's a high turnover, which leaves the other workers that are left to get piled on with cases. I know the national average for caseloads are like 12 to 15 cases, but our workers in Anchorage average at least 30 cases, mm-hmm. and they just keep coming. I'm an OTR worker.
I'm sorry, what's an OTR worker?
Out-of-town request, which means kiddos come from another region, and for whatever reason, they're here, and the case originated in another region. Mm-hmm. So I have to do just caseworker visits on those cases. I have over 89 cases, 89-plus cases that I have to see kids in a monthly basis, and they just keep coming. And I know they say there's help coming, it's on the way, but somebody is obviously not doing something right because the workers just keep leaving. Mm-hmm. They're leaving because they're burnt out, they're getting overloaded, and it's hard to keep the pace with the amount of cases that are coming in. And we're told to take care of ourselves, but it's hard to take care of yourself when you take leave or sick and you're out. And then when you come back, it's just more work to be done when you come in. And so, like I told one of my supervisors and several other people, it's only so much you can do. Everybody has a breaking point. You can mm-hmm. bend so much before you break, and that's what's happening. Those people that are leaving, they've been at their breaking point, and they can't take anymore. Some people can handle more than others. But the main thing is we just continually get cases, and it looks like there's no end in sight, because if everybody's leaving or half of the people are gone, then the other people, like I said, are continually getting more work. I mean, I get OTRs, I get another kiddo or another case almost daily. Mm-hmm. And it's just unreal the amount of work and the amount of expectations we're supposed to have to complete work. And we can't do effective casework. I'm sure a lot of my coworkers would like to be able to be more involved, but it's hard to be as involved to be able to do all the things you need to do when you have so many people to see. Mm-hmm. And I don't think people understand or realize that. And it's kind of unusual or unreal, because if we have twice the amount of caseload that the national average for caseworkers, but we get paid the same amount of pay that a normal caseworker would get paid. I think that's a problem in itself. I mean, they tell you, oh, overtime is available, but who wants to work extra to do the amount of work you should be able to finish in a normal work day and get paid for it? So it just looks like there's no end in sight.
Mr. Patton, I'm going to let Christy Lawton, the director of OCS, respond to some of your concerns.
Yes, thanks for calling in, Mister. And he's really speaking the truth. I mean, I think he is portraying a lot of how our caseworkers experience the job day to day, and it takes a heavy toll. Mister's unique in that he's been with us actually for quite a long time and has worked his way up. So he has found obviously some coping mechanisms to deal with the workload, but he's also one of the types of workers that we want to keep because of how much we've invested in the skills and the passion that he brings to the job. But they're overwhelmed, and it is a job that is emotionally taxing. Anchorage is going to receive some new positions, so they will be receiving some relief, but you know, it's going to take time for us to hire them. And in the meantime, you know, we do have a staff advisory board that we try to use as a gauge to try to figure out, besides, you know, reducing caseloads overnight, which mm-hmm. we just simply can't do, are there other ways that we can support them? It is hard. You know, we do talk about self-care, but it is truly a really difficult thing to do mm-hmm. And practice every day, especially when, you know, your to-do list when you leave at night isn't about, you know, did I check the box and fill out the form? It's about kids and families that you think potentially are in danger and that you maybe haven't seen. And so those are the choices our staff have to make, mm-hmm. Which is very difficult. I think with the HB 151, it is going to give us the best chance we've ever had up until this point to stabilize workforce, but it is going to take time. And sadly, we are going to lose good caseworkers in the meantime while we're working to stabilize that. But we're going to make every effort to try to keep people like Mr. and some of his colleagues, because those are the people that are really the future leaders of the organization and have the experience that our families need.
Mr., thank you so much for calling in. We're going to go now to Eleanor in Manicotic. Eleanor, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Hi, Special Officer. This is white families you're talking about, but I wanted to bring out the fact that when we started this tribal government team with CIA, they did a training in 1994, and they said when the state takes a tribal child that it was kidnapping. Mm-hmm. And they did a lot of that, and it seems like it's just another program like they did when the BIA schools used to take children away and raise them there, and like missionaries did the same thing. And a very domestic, we talk about domestic violence, that is the very process of the state discipline that they practice on these kids, that they use on their children. And that's a lot of parents have died, and 1% of these children that are placed in their foster care system end up homeless and are on the street. Mm-hmm. You should have your statistics, right?
Yeah. Eleanor, you're breaking up a little bit, but what I hear you asking about, and so I hope I heard you correctly, is I hear you asking a bit about the relationship between OCS and the tribes and negative outcomes for kids. And so I'd like to turn to Christy and kind of talk a little bit about what's happening with relationships between OCS and the tribes. And I apologize if I misheard you, Eleanor.
Yeah, so Eleanor, if I am hearing what you're talking about, I think historically our relationship with tribes and really state government generally is come from a much different place. We know that, you know, the Indian Child Welfare Act was created specifically because states all around the world were shipping children of color to adoptive homes that they thought suitably, particularly Alaska Native and American Indian. These days, in 2018, we have worked for the last almost three decades now developing strong relationships with tribes and tribal organizations, and we involve them at every step of the way when we're working with a family. And really, my direction to our staff is that the tribe is the lead. If the tribe is involved in the case, they should be taking point on helping us make decisions on what's best for children. I think more exciting work is coming under the Alaska Tribal Child Welfare Compact that was signed in October 2017 at the Alaska Federation of Natives annual meeting, and that really is a government-to-government agreement that's going to allow, not allow, but is going to provide a vehicle to tribes to take over more of the delivery of child welfare services with the funding to go along with it, which is a key aspect of that, is that we can't ask tribes to take on the work that the state is legally required to do without helping to ensure that they have the funding to do the work properly. And so we're really excited about that.
All right. Thank you so much for calling in, Eleanor. I'm turning to email now. Bobby asks, how does this bill affect children that are in a placement that is not going to be a forever home? There's a special needs teen currently in my home that, being a forever home, would need to live at home for life. To be honest, this scares me from being a forever home for this child. Les.
Well, so when we talk about a forever home, that's an adoptive home. It's a guardian, which is like an adoptive home, or it's a reunification with your natural parents. And certainly the higher need the child is, the harder that is to do. But, you know, the way the bill is set up, it is to make sure the best chance possible is out there to match a child, especially with a relative, an aunt, a grandmother. Through this and some prior bills we've passed, we've strengthened that function. So there's going to be a greater likelihood that a child is going to be placed with a relative or a friend of a relative. That is more likely to going to become a forever home because there's already that love bond there. I can't speak to the circumstance here. It's to pretend that 100% of youth are going to be placed into a forever home within 12 months. You know, we want to get the numbers way, way, way better than they are. And there's a lot in this bill that will do this. You know, in New Jersey, we followed the New Jersey model, which was they were forced by court order. Their system was so messed up. But the number of youth placed with family members has gone up because caseworkers have the time to go out and find the families now. Casey Family Programs, the nation's largest foster care nonprofit, says most systems engage in crisis management. What we want is customer service. This bill is going to be about customer service, not crisis management, which requires you to make mistakes, which requires you to not find the right home. And there are many provisions in this and prior bills we passed that will match youth with family homes, which are more likely to going to become loving forever homes.
All right. And
Can I just add, I just wanted to thank Bobby for the care that she's providing. And if I understood what she was describing, it sounds like she has a young person in her home that has some potentially complex special needs. And that is a challenge that we sort of butt up against, because federal law does require us to get children to permanency, meaning they aren't in the foster care system. But there are a small percentage of foster youth that come to us with amazingly complex and challenging needs, whereby if a family does finalize that adoption, some of the services they might have been entitled to don't exist anymore. And so it really is a conundrum of trying to make sure the child's needs are met, that they don't stay in foster care, but we recognize that there are families that need that support, and that is really scary thing to sign on to be a permanent home and not know that you're going to have all the resources and supports that you need to care for the child.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to turn now to Matt in Anchorage. Matt, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Hi.
Hi.
So my question was, and it kind of followed that email regards to special needs, because my in-laws are currently fostering a young autistic boy, but I have a lot of experience through a previous relationship with an autistic child, but the state hasn't pushed him actually getting diagnosed or seeing any sort of specialist to get diagnosed. I was wondering what is something that the family can do to try and help push your guys' organization to get him to a specialist to find out. You know, I know my experience. I'm wondering how, you know, mm-hmm. to actually get a doctor to either say yay or nay.
Thank you, Matt.
Yeah, and Matt, this is Christy Lawton. I guess there's a couple of different things. I mean, it's hard to know exactly what's happening in this particular case. But certainly the reality is we rely heavily on our foster and relative providers to be those advocates. And so taking them to various doctors to try to find those people, we do have some people in Anchorage that, you know, are more skilled at dealing with children with autism than others. I would also encourage you to engage with the guardian ad litem or the CASA if there is one on the case. They also would be great advocates if your in-laws are not being heard about their needs. I'd also just encourage people that if they're having communication challenges generally and you're not being heard, don't be shy about calling the supervisor or the manager or whoever you need to reach out to, including myself, in order to be heard and have those child's needs be addressed.
Amanda, with the kids that you work with, young people that you work with, if they personally don't feel like their needs are being met, what advice do you give them?
We actually worked over the last few years with OCS to develop first a Bill of Rights for teenagers in foster care, so they understand what rights they do have. House Bill 151 also addresses engaging youth ages 14 and older in their case plan and being able to identify supportive adults who can help with that process. But we really try to equip youth as much as possible with information, knowledge on how the system works, how they can participate in it. And if they feel like they're not being heard, we try to make sure that they have contact information for their caseworker, for their GAL, for their attorney if they have one. And also, I mean, sometimes some youth are better self-advocates than others. But again, if they have a supportive adult like a foster parent or a CASA volunteer, usually those people are advocating for them and speaking up for maybe what the youth's expressed interests are.
All right. We are going to take a quick break and then come back to more of your calls here on Talk of Alaska.
Today's program is underwritten in part by Matson, committed to the communities it serves, building on more than 50 years of service to the communities of Alaska. Learn more at matson.com.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. Today we're talking about the foster care system and ways to improve it. I'd like to go to Wilson in Bethel. Welcome to Talk of Alaska. Wilson, are you still with us?
Yes, I am.
Hi.
Yes, I am.
Welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Yeah, I'm still here.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any comments or questions?
Hello. Oh, yeah. This is Wilson Green. I'm calling from beautiful downtown Bethel. Even though Bethel is kind of ugly, that's my hometown. But anyway, what kind of improvements are
you guys planning in Anchorage for kids in foster care or, you know, temporary foster care that to improve your working relationship with your own agency office here in Bethel.
That's
right now, it's been 1 year and 2 months since my granddaughter has been in OCS care.
Mm-hmm.
And, we're trying to get her back home.
Mm-hmm.
My daughter, she messed up, but now she went through treatment. She completed aftercare. She went through a whole bunch of other hoops that these folks here in Bethel said, yeah, you do this, and then, or actually the people in Anchorage mm-hmm. said, you do this, you do this, you do this, and mm-hmm. then you'll get your daughter back.
Mm-hmm.
And every time it's kicked back 3-6 months later, you still have to do this now. And we try to work with the people here in Bethel mm-hmm. to get it transferred here to the case transferred to Bethel because we're from Bethel. And every time we call, the caseworker is not available, voicemail. The manager or supervisor for OCS as a whole, voicemail. No one returns calls. And then later on in through court proceeding or whatever, they say, this family is not participating. I mean, we'll give them economic more time for mm-hmm. the child to be in foster care. You know, to me, that's wrong. And that's mm-hmm. all I wanted to share.
Okay.
The injustice that's going on our behalf and trying to reunite my granddaughter with us here in Bethel. It's not happening. I'll listen.
Thanks very much for your call, Wilson.
Yeah, I think Wilson has identified really one of our biggest challenges, which is good communication internally to our organization as well as externally. And I think that one of the drivers of that is the workload of the caseworkers.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the only one, but we know that we do have challenges with offices coordinating services between one another and keeping that good communication. I think some of the things that we do to try to mitigate that are having, for example, we have statewide ICWA specialists, Indian Child Welfare Act specialists, and they are really geared to help intervene in cases where we're not communicating well. I would also encourage Wilson, you can feel free to email me directly at christy.lawton@alaska.gov with your information. I'd be happy to follow up and see if I can't shake loose what's happening in your particular case.
So let's talk a little bit about the rural-urban divide. Is there special training anyone will be receiving or is receiving regarding understanding working with people from other cultures that may not be your own or communication styles across cultural divides?
There isn't a training that is just for workers in rural areas. We provide statewide training
yeah.
for all of our staff mm-hmm. on working with different cultures, particularly Alaska Native history and the historical trauma that's happened. We have, of course, training on ICWA, the federal law, specifically advanced and sort of intermediate. And then we also have a training called Knowing Who You Are, which is really geared to help the worker understand the role of culture in an individual's being and how they conduct themselves every day and to try to make those connections within themselves so they can help them make those connections with the people they serve.
Mm-hmm.
We also rely heavily on our tribal partners, particularly in our smaller office areas, and really ask them to help sort of be that cultural attaché, if you will, that helps to guide the workers specifically to that community. Because with 229 tribes in Alaska, they're not all the same, and you can't train about them all in the same way. So it is an area that we still have a lot of room for growth, I would say, but is something we talk about and work with our tribal partners often to figure out how to build that into the workforce and do so in a way that is in on step with the turnover, which is the constant challenge that we hope we're going to solve with 151.
All right. And I'd like to go back to the phones from Bethel. We have Tamara on the line. Tamara, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Hello, this is Tamara.
Tamara.
Anyway, I want to talk about, you know, what Wilson Green was talking about, you know, the OCS in Anchorage. There's no communication, no return calls back. That is true. And you talk about email. I'm not even sure if you guys do respond back on email either. And, you know, OCS is supposed to have a limit of, it's supposed to be 60 days no longer than 60 days and the child is supposed to come back to the parents after they do their treatment and everything. But it's been more than 60 days since my granddaughter got taken away. And, you know, I'm still waiting to see her. And even the foster parents, they tell saying stuff like, she needs this, she needs that. But really, she's just a baby. How does she expect a baby to be, know all the books and everything? I mean, really, that's really stupid. And then, you know, my daughter, she doesn't even hear from her caseworker at all. And I'm getting so tired of hearing her saying that she's been trying and trying to try contact the caseworker. It's so impossible. I don't know why you guys don't clean up your messages or anything so we could leave a message for you guys to return call or something. And then you guys say stuff like, you don't update what they're doing and everything. And she's been really trying.
Tamara, I'd like to let Laskara respond to your concerns.
Hi, Tamara. Your experience, Wilson's experience, this is exactly what we're trying to change with this bill. So we're talking about the OCS of the past, which was underfunded, a system in crisis, and what we want is customer service where you get your phone calls back. We can't do that when you have caseloads of 20, 30, or 40 cases per worker, who then that worker then gets overwhelmed and leaves, and then you get a new worker who doesn't even understand your case. And that causes the delay, the kinds of delay you're talking about. And so what we're going to do is reduce the number of cases a caseworker carries so they can return your phone calls. So you don't see a new caseworker every single time your case languishes. So we do get to move your child back into a permanent home faster. Exactly what you're talking about is sort of the OCS of today. It's not able to do the work that it needs to be able to do with overwhelmed caseworkers and staggering caseloads. That's exactly what we're going to change. We hope the OCS in the future sort of is the OCS of the future very, very soon. So these stories don't happen. That's exactly why we filed this bill. It's exactly why your representative, Tiffany Zelkowski, was a great supporter of this bill to change the kinds of things that are happening to your family so that we have youth reunified with their parents much more quickly. And it's worked in other places. That's what we're going to do here. There was a mistaken statement before that the average caseload around the country is around 12 cases per worker. That's the ideal caseload. Most foster care systems are messed up around the country. We don't want to be one of those foster care systems anymore.
And, I mean, people are, the last two callers are working directly with their kids. They want their grandkids back with their families back in Bethel. I guess one question that popped up in my mind is they both seem to imply that their kids are being involved with caseworkers in Anchorage. What determines which office kids are assigned to, cases are assigned to, I guess?
So typically the office that gets assigned is depending on where the removal of the child happened. So if kids and family are here in Anchorage, this is where they live. Typically the Anchorage office will be assigned, but the child may be placed, for example, in Bethel because that's where the relatives, and that's where then you bring in a secondary worker that's going to be working with them.
All right. That is all we have time for today. I'd like to thank all of my guests for joining me on Talk of Alaska. We had Sarah Redmond, a former foster youth and an advocate, Amanda Mativier, Director of Facing Foster Care in Alaska, Christy Lawton, Director of the Office of Children's Services, and Representative Laskara, who worked to advocate for a recent bill that is hopefully going to reduce workloads for caseworkers and change some of the issues callers have talked about. He called in to speak about. This is Talk of Alaska on Alaska Public Media. Thanks very much for listening.
Talk of Alaska is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. This program is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400. This is Alaska Public Media.